Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
It will be a nervous 90 minutes for a man who won in Munich's Olympic Stadium and very nearly in the San Siro in Milan. But the Mike Walker choice is positive, giving last week's team the chance to get them out of trouble.
Good evening. Police in Gloucester tonight discovered what they believe are the remains of two more bodies in the cellar of a house in the city.
Wimbledon's coach was burnt out last night at their team hotel in what the police are describing as suspicious circumstances.
Right-wing parties in South Africa have confirmed that they'll boycott the country's first multiracial elections next month. The decision was taken in Pretoria at a meeting of the Afrikaner People's Front, an alliance of groups demanding self-rule for whites.
Empire just got a chance for that. No penalty! Handball! Handball by Anders Empire.
In America, the Clinton administration was shaken today with the resignation of the president's chief White House lawyer in connection with the Whitewater property affair.
Unsworth, two together, and Ablett cannot keep it out. Clark gets the congratulations of the Wimbledon players. The fact that two went to head the same ball was the cause of that goal.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller, and joining me as always, Jonathan Wilson. And joining us is James Corbett, author, founder and principal of De Coubertin Books and correspondent for offthepitch.com. James, pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we go back to Goodison Park on the last day of the 1993-94 Premiership season, Everton 3, Wimbledon 2, The Great Escape. James, why have you chosen this game?
I think because it was the sort of consummation of my love for Everton. So I sort of had this foolish expectation that Everton would win everything because I was first taken to the game in 1985. They narrowly missed out on the league and cup double to Liverpool that year, and then went on and won the league title. And I still, you know, believed wholeheartedly in Everton, even when they went into decline under Colin Harvey and Howard Kendall in his second period. By the end of the 93-94 season, Mike Walker's manager, and there's this precipitous decline from mid-table to the relegation places. But I still believed that they would stay up, no matter how bad they were. I just couldn't, for the life of me, imagine that they would go down. And the game itself was probably the most dramatic and weirdest I've ever been to. Weird because they were redeveloping the park stand at Goodison at the time, so there was just an empty void at the end, and you could see over into Stanley Park. On that day in particular, you could see people climbing the trees to get a view of the game. And this free-sided ground was alternatively very, very eerie and just a cacophony of noise and chaos.
It was an incredible day. Last day of the season, Jonathan. A number of teams could be relegated.
Yeah, so there's four teams could have joined. I mean, Oldham and Swindon were already down. Four teams could have joined them. And Everton were a point behind Ipswich, Sheffield United and Southampton.
And four teams went down in those days?
No, three went down.
Oh, was it three? Sorry, yeah.
So even a win might not have been enough. But they certainly had to get a win to give themselves a chance.
Yeah, which they did. But, you know, as you were saying, James, you know, Everton in the 1980s were incredible. You know, league titles and FA Cup wins and so on and so forth. So there was great expectation. But into the 90s, as you mentioned earlier, it wasn't working out for them, really.
No, it wasn't. Howard Kendall left as manager in 1987, and Colin Harvey was the popular choice to take over. And he still had the core of the team, but you know, quality players were drifting away because of the European ban. They'd obviously lost the manager because of that. Harvey was given lots and lots of money. He bought Tony Cotty for a British record transfer fee. He bought players like Pat Nevin, Stuart McCall, but none of them were quite as good as the players they came in to replace. And there was a rift in the dressing room between the old guard, people like Graham Sharp and Kevin Ratcliffe, and the new players. You also had the club in a bit of a state of flux because the club's patriarch, John Moores, was nearing the end of his life. There was Moores had either been chairman himself or had Littlewood's executives running the club throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s, but by the early 90s, it was a local GP who was chairman, and he was there seemingly because he was John Moores' bridge partner.
Okay.
He was an Everton supporter, but he didn't have that sort of business dynamism that someone like Sir Philip Carter had. So there was no money coming into the club. The crowds had started to drift away, and although Everton had been one of the key drivers behind the Premier League, or the creation of the Premier League, they seem least adept to adapt to this new environment.
Yeah, but Goodison Park, they're having somewhat of a facelift, as you say, because the stand behind the goal was not there during this game.
That's correct, yeah. It had been knocked down earlier in the season. Uh-huh. And it seemed to symbolise the club at the time, to be honest. You know, you go every 10 days or 2 weeks and a bit more would be knocked down and you know, by the time of the Wimbledon game, and it had absolutely been flattened.
Yeah, and previous seasons in the early 90s, talking about the decline, Jonathan, Everton, they had been dropping off. They sort of top half, it was sort of sixth place or whatever it was, ninth. and then dropping off, and then they were sort of 13th, I think, or around there the season before, and you could see this decline.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it's quite striking when you think that Everton, as you say, were one of the five key drivers behind the formation of the Premier League or Premiership, and then you look at this team.
Yeah,
and that doesn't look like a top five team.
No.
It looks quite a long way off being a top five team. I mean, obviously, you know, Cotty had been great at West Ham and never really worked for him in the same way at Everton. Southall, I guess, is, you know, an all-time great keeper, but not the goalkeeper he'd been sort of 6 or 7 years earlier. Dave Watson coming towards the end of his career. It's a pretty sort of mix and match side. You know, Anders Limpar, obviously hugely skillful, but again, not what he'd been in his Arsenal heyday. And then... The thing that, yeah, the club that sort of showed up everybody at the time is Wimbledon. They played horrible football. They were horrible to play against. They're horrible to watch. Finished sixth this season.
Yeah.
You know, even in 88, sort of a supposed fairy tale of FA Cup, they did finish seventh in the league that season.
Yeah, it's remarkable. A team.
It's a fairy tale in the sense of the resources and where they come from. But they were a team who kind of, you know, had consistently over the season proved themselves to be a decent side in 87, 88. And, you know, this team, there's a lot of big players in there. It's a very physical side. But you've got players like Robbie Earle, who are proper footballers as well.
Vinnie Jones as well.
Less of a proper footballer, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously Everton had not played well at all that season. They found themselves in trouble. I mean, why was that? Was this decline of players and so on? Was there sort of pressure getting to them? I mean, what were the sort of real reasons for the season in particular, James?
Well, I think they won their first three games of that season and actually went top and then lost the next three. And It was one of those seasons where I don't think they were set for anything other than mediocrity. But Howard Kendall had fallen out with David Marsh, the aforementioned bridge playing chairman, because he was not given the funds to sign Dion Dublin, and Howard just left, had enough.
And Dion Dublin had playing brilliantly for Cambridge at the time.
Yeah,
ends up going to United instead.
Yeah, and he played a part with you. I mean, He'd broken his leg previously, but he'd also played a part when United won their first title in, was it 26 years? He'd come in. And he was versatile as well. He could play at centre-back. So he would have been a very good signing. He did very well at Coventry, did very well at Villa, played for England as well after that. So Howard had walked out, and against that backdrop, Moores had died a couple of months earlier, so there was a takeover battle for the club between Bill Kenwright, the fitter, impresario, and Peter Johnson, the Tranmere chairman, and nobody was making decisions. And I think they went 6 weeks without appointing a new manager. They had Jimmy Gabriel as caretaker, and he lost all six of his games in charge over the Christmas period. And from being ninth, they suddenly find themselves teetering around the bottom.
Yeah.
And Mike Walker, the Norwich manager, came in and had an initial bounce, but the club just couldn't build on that.
Well, Mike Walker's a really odd case in that he obviously did a brilliant thing at Norwich, and the other season when Norwich were in the title race until sort of April, it was a game when they lost 3-1 at home to United when it finally sort of tipped United's way, and then they have the following season when they're going great guns in Europe and they're beating Bayern Munich, and then he sort of couldn't do it anywhere else. He had sort of two seasons, and that was it. And he never seemed a comfortable fit at Everton. So seemed fans sort of turned on him pretty quickly.
I don't actually know that they did turn on him. I think there was a belief in him being a promising young manager, and Norwich played really good football. I suppose if you want a comparison, Norwich were a bit like Wigan under Roberto Martinez, in that they played this fantastic attacking football, but couldn't defend. So they finished. Did they finish runners up or third?
I think they finished third with a negative goal difference.
Yeah, with a negative goal difference, which is unbelievable and tells you an awful lot. Norwich came to Goodison earlier in the 93-94 season and wiped the floor with Everton. They won 5-1. Efanakuku ran rings around the defence. And I think that probably sent a message to, you know, whatever powers there were in the Goodison boardroom, that this was a good manager. Walker came in. As I said, the players didn't like him. They didn't like his training regimes. They didn't like Dave Williams as assistant manager. Whereas I think John Dean had been very influential at Norwich as Walker's assistant. He didn't follow him to Goodison. I think, did Dean succeed him? I can't remember now.
Oh, I don't know. Dean
did eventually succeed him, but he didn't come to Goodison. I think that had an impact. But you know, Walker brought in some good players. You know, his track record in the transfer market was pretty good. He brought in Limpar, Joe Parkinson, who was an unknown and who would have probably gone on to play for England for many years had his career not been ended by injury. He later brought in Duncan Ferguson, of course, and Daniel Amakachi. Vinny Samways we won't talk about. That was less successful. But he could see a good player, but he couldn't motivate the players to play the system that he wanted.
Well, so my memory of him was of him. I mean, yeah, this is the memory of sort of how old was I by then? So late teens by then. My memory was he got to Everton. He suddenly became this incredibly tetchy bloke who was always sort of giving very short TV interviews. And it may be I've sort of conflated kind of what happened later, but I sort of the sense I have is sort of like almost immediately was like, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I don't think he could deal with the pressure very well.
Do you think? Yeah. I mean, obviously, you said that it was that 6 week period where they didn't have a manager, but Howard Kendall, who's you know royalty around there, a tough act to follow. You know, do you think it was just too much for him stepping into those shoes?
Possibly. I mean, it was a strong dressing room despite Everton's decline. You know, you had big characters there like Dave Watson and Neville Southall, Barry Horn, who captained Wales. David Unsworth, who was an up-and-coming player, you know, was a big personality, and I just don't think he could. I don't think he could come in and handle them. I always think the hardest thing for a manager to do is to step into a dressing room and get a dozen or 15 young men to believe in them, and he couldn't do that.
He couldn't. All right, we're going to have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about the match itself. See you in a moment.
Graham Stewart to take. He has to score.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Bit of tease from Limpar. Stewart. Stewart again. Yes! Two goals in the match for Graham Stewart.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Now then, let's talk about that sunny afternoon at Goodison Park. As we say, you know, it was a pretty dire situation for Everton. They needed to win the game and also hope that a few other results went their way. So it's the win was obviously...
Well, they only needed one of those results to go their way.
Okay, yeah. But the win itself wasn't enough. They did need that. A result or two, of course. And it couldn't have gone any worse than the first 20 minutes, really, could it, for Everton?
Well, no, it couldn't. I mean, before we talk about the game, I just want to talk about the build-up to the game.
Oh, yeah, please
do. Because extraordinarily, it wasn't an all-ticket game. And I was at an age at that time, 14, 15, where I'd started to go with my mates instead of my dad and my grandfather and my uncles. And we all had a thing called a junior Evertonian card, which you present at the turnstile and you get a fiver off. So you get into the match for £3 or £4 when, at a time when you could earn 13 quid a week as a paperboy. So it was a pretty good deal. So I'd gone with my mates, but we had no way of buying the tickets beforehand, even if we wanted to. So we said, right, we'll get there early. We'll get there at 11 o'clock. Nobody's going to get there at 11 o'clock. So we walked up to Goodison from Kirkdale Station, and there's just thousands of people everywhere, and you literally couldn't move in Gladys Street itself going up to the terrace.
What would the capacity have been with the end not being?
It was about 32,000, 33,000.
Oh, is it still as big as that? Okay,
yeah, but you know you probably had 12,000 season ticket holders, and then everybody else trying to pay.
Yeah.
Paying on the gate 4 hours beforehand. So there were horseback policemen there, and one of the coppers said, you know, you're not going to get in, lads. So I said, well, you know, I want to take my chances. And he said, well, there's room in the Wimbledon end, but you need to have a Cockney. So we had this dilemma, you know, do we abandon the queue? And we've been told we're probably not going to get in, or do we go and try and find a Wimbledon supporter? Whenever Wimbledon came to Goodison, me and my dad would count the Wimbledon fans because they never had any. You know, they had 50, 60 coming with them. So I said, look, there's no chance we're going to find a Cockney. I'll just wait here and try and get in. So my mates went off, and that was the last I saw of them that day. The turnstiles opened early, and I literally got in, and they shut behind me, perhaps two or three other people behind me. So I got in by the skin of my teeth. But I'm in the ground 3 hours before kickoff. And what do you do? You know, there's no pre-match entertainment or anything.
Have a phone to play with?
No, no. You had a fanzine. I had When Skies Are Grey fanzine, which was 60 pence and had a very famous, just all-black cover. So I read that and just waited and waited for Everton to meet their fate. And then, of course, as you say, the game kicked off and it couldn't have got off to a worse start.
I mean, what an incredible wait that must have been. What was the feeling? Was it nervous? I mean, you mentioned earlier that people just thought we'll be OK.
Well, no, I thought we'd be OK.
OK.
And I suppose when you're 15, you don't really think about what other people are thinking.
Maybe, yeah.
I just had this sort of sense of invincibility about things.
Oh, yeah. What do you think... I mean, I'm sort of a great believer that it is possible during a game to get a sense of what's happening. You sort of, if you go to enough football, if you've been to enough football, you can smell a result. And so, yeah, in Istanbul, as soon as Gerrard scored, I was certain Liverpool would win the game.
Yeah, but that's because Liverpool are in league with the devil. I mean,
well, maybe that's what you smell. When Sunderland won 2-1 away at Chelsea in one of the great escape seasons, And even though Sunderland conceded quite early to Samuel Eto'o goal, I had this sense that it'll be fine. We've won this. I don't understand why it's going to happen. And it required Connor Wickham to have a game of his life. But I do think you can.
But England beating Germany 5-1 away under old Sven. Like when as soon as they equalised, I thought, we'll win and we'll win big.
Right.
Genuinely, it's an odd one. Yeah. I know what you mean. Sometimes there is a sense.
I mean, and obviously there's a bit of confirmation bias. You forget the ones when it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
But I think it is sort of, it's very hard to explain, but if you've been to, I don't know how many football matches I've been to, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, however many, you kind of somehow can read the signs. So do you think you were doing that, or was it just sort of this naive confidence that this can't happen to Everton?
Well, yeah, partly naive confidence, but years later, I worked with Neville Southall on his autobiography, and it was one of the first things that we talked about, that Wimbledon game. And Neville just said, I never thought we were going to go down. I never, ever, ever thought we were going to go down, no matter what happened. If Wimbledon scored 5, we'd score 6. That sort of thing. And I don't think he sniffed blood. He knew there were going to be days when Everton would win, you know, during the glory years, or when they beat Man United a year later in the FA Cup. But, yeah, he just had this sense of invincibility as well.
Yeah. Well, 4 minutes old, the game was, and Everton give away a daft penalty. I mean, it was Andras Limpar who sort of, he handles the ball.
Well, as a corner comes in, and I don't know whether it's just sort of Wimbledon terrify teams so much with their physical power, and it is a big team.
And he's a small guy.
And he sort of just sticks his hand up and flicks it away.
But I mean, yeah, there's no real danger at that moment.
That's all I can think is his brain was scrambled by kind of a fear of what Wimbledon could do to you from set pieces.
Well, that's what Limpar later told me when I asked
right,
him.
Right, okay.
It was right in front of me, probably no more than 10 metres away from me. And he sort of turned. I'm acting it out now in a podcast, you know, as stupid as it. He sort of turned and sort of caught the ball and it was almost as if he knew what he was doing. It was just bizarre. And, of course, the referee, Robbie Hart, gives the penalty, which Southall gets a hand to, but it's not quite enough. And then Goodison,
it's Dean Holdsworth's penalty.
Yeah. Robbie Hart was the referee.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Dean Holdsworth, yeah, tucks away the penalty. Worst start you could think of.
Yeah, and Goodison went to a hush. And then, you know, the wind starts coming in across the empty park stand. And then people get galvanised again and they start cheering and shouting, but they're quickly silenced.
Yeah, well, yeah, so sort of 16 minutes after.
Well,
and
again, it looks like a brain scrambled goal. It's just a long ball in the box. And it's Watson and Horn jump into each other.
It's definitely
it?
Watson.
Is it Barry Horn jumps into him?
Yeah, there's two Everton defenders who both go for the same ball.
Yeah, it was Gary Ablett who scored the own.
Yeah,
goal,
no, when it comes to Andy Clark,
yeah,
he's a terrible football player. Jesus Christ, he's an awful footballer. but it sends it, you know, managed to direct it goalwards, and Ablett kind of trying to kind of hook it out ends up sort of bundling into his own net.
But the reason why it falls to Clark is because the two Everton defenders go up for the header. And
yeah, but under no pressure.
Under no pressure, cancel each other out. Yeah. And it drops to Clark, and he says, well, thanks very much. He hits it. It's probably going to go just wide. And he's given us an own goal because Ablett tries to defend it or get rid of it, and it hits him. And it then just loops into the net, and Ablett scrambles back, and he just can't quite get his. It makes it seem so inevitable that Everton, not inevitable is not the right word. It emphasises how they are nervous and struggling, and the importance of the game is surely on the forefront of their minds, and they're just not dealing with that.
Well, and the other thing you have to think of is the effect that must have had on the other three teams who are in the relegation battle, that they would all have been, yeah, their fans are all there, their transistor radios like pinned to their ears. Or Everton are 2-0 down from a penalty and an own goal.
Yeah.
They must have been thinking, well, thank God for that, we're safe. Yeah.
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 But it's still, though, you're confident, James, at this point.
I am confident. And the other weird thing is I wasn't conscious of anything that was going on elsewhere in the Premiership that day.
Yeah.
Whether it was, I mean, I didn't have my own transistor radio, but I was just seemingly oblivious to any rumours or what other people were telling me.
Yeah.
But the Ablett own goal was just weird. It just seemed to happen in slow motion.
Yeah.
I almost felt like I could jump out my seat and sort of stop it myself.
Yeah. Well, it was so you probably could have done, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
My goodness.
Because, well, I mean, Ablett gets so close to clearing it. Yeah. It's one of those sort of agonising.
I think that's the word, agonising. And then they're 2-0 down and struggling. But then 4 minutes later, Anders Limpar wins a penalty.
Well,
and he very much won that penalty.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Yes.
You would say, I mean, would you say it was a dive, or would you say he's even a bit more clever? That might be too harsh.
He was. He was a clever player in an era before clever players.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If you saw it now, it would be VAR'd to death.
It would.
Yeah. And so Peter Fear goes in to challenge him. So half pulls out the challenge. He's just sort of standing there, and Limpar makes sure his foot hits Fear's leg and goes over.
And we see that all the time now, as you say, James. But back then, he won that.
Yeah, penalty. I mean, I have to say, when you see it from the sort of the normal camera on the halfway line, it does look a penalty. It's only when you see it from behind the goal you realise that
It's questionable.
He's manufactured that contact.
Yeah. But Graeme Stewart steps up.
Well, no, he didn't step up originally.
Oh, right. Okay.
Neville Southall did. And again, we step forward 17 years, and I'm working with Neville on his book.
Right.
And I kept a teenage diary of match reports and had one of that day. And I have this interlude of Neville Southall picking up the ball and marching forward from his own half. And I'm like, that didn't happen. No way. And I watched the YouTube highlights, and, you know, there's no reference to it. You couldn't really get the match reports on the internet then, so I had no other reference. So I asked Neville about it, and he said, yeah. He said, nobody else was going to do it, so I did it. So Neville marches forward with the ball, and Graeme Stewart, who'd never actually scored for Everton at that point and had never taken a penalty in professional football, took the ball off Neville.
And he'd come in from Chelsea, earlier that season?
Yeah, he'd been our big signing at the start of the season. Our only signing, I think. But
And he hadn't scored?
He hadn't scored. He hadn't really done an awful lot at that stage.
Right.
And he took the ball off Neville.
Why? Just because thinking, no, we're better off having a striker than a goalkeeper hit it.
Yeah, he said. I mean, I asked him about it later, and he said, you know, I couldn't let the goalkeeper do it. Whereas Neville had scored in a penalty shootout in the Four Members Cup in 1987, and never, ever, ever, and still hasn't let anybody forget about it. So, you know, he was, you know, I'm the most experienced player and I've got a 100% penalty record, so I'm going to take it. Graeme Stewart's like, no, this is a farce. I'm taking the ball off you. And Stewart scored and Everton went in at half-time.
Well, thanks to Holdsworth missing. Oh.
Yeah.
4 yards out, puts the header over.
Yeah, I mean, it really should have been 3-1 Wimbledon at half.
And then there's another chance he has that, I mean, it's a much harder chance, but Gale gets down the left, pings a cross in. And he can't, because there's so much power on the cross, he can't quite control the header. But that was a good chance as well. So Holdsworth missed two really good chances. I mean, and the header he puts over from 4 yards is extraordinary.
Yes.
But again, I'm sure not all Evertonians were maybe as confident as you, but to get into half-time at 2-1 down, they would have probably been thinking, right, blimey, something has to change. And, you know, looking at other results, you know, on the radios and so on and so forth. So the second half begins, and again, as you say, Jonathan, you know, there are more sort of Wimbledon chances probably than Everton chances to begin with.
Well, there's the Stewart chance that Segers makes a good save from.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
He ends up taking it quite wide and it's kind of a narrow angle, but Segers kind of gets himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good block. But then there's the chance, and it's another hold to the header at the back post.
Yeah, and John Ebrill headed it off the line.
Holdsworth can't quite work out what's happened and is appealing for handball, but it sort of hit him sort of top of the chest. But also, Southall's in a weird position for that. He sort of gets drawn towards whoever it is who puts the cross in from the right, and he's sort of scrambling back across goal. And that's another great chance that Holdsworth spurned, because he had sort of 7 yards of goal to aim at and headed straight at Ebrill. Wimbledon had the chances to put that to bed.
Yeah, but they didn't. And so the game's going sort of a little bit back and forth. And then up steps Mr. Horn in the 67th minute.
The greatest goal I've ever seen. Barry Horn had come in two summers earlier and he'd scored on his debut and hadn't scored since.
Yeah.
And hadn't really done anything. And he stepped forward that day. He took a loose ball off Vinnie Jones and the ball just bounced up for him perfectly.
But he sort of, he takes a quite nice touch with his thigh, but the bounce is then still very kind.
Yeah.
And he half volleys it and it's sort of
25, 30 yards out?
Yeah. Yeah. Even 40 yards.
Yeah. Yeah. It was about 80 yards out.
My adolescent memory. I was right behind the goal and could see the trajectory of this shot, and it just goes in the...
I mean, it's a ridiculous swerve on it as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a beauty.
It's an amazing goal.
Mm. There's no chance that he controlled that, though. He's just smashed that towards the goal. And
We'd never seen anything like it from Barry Horn. He'd never even attempted to shoot outside.
Well, and then 5 minutes later, he tried it again, and not far over.
Yeah, and it went just over the bar.
Mm. But at 2-2, it's all change.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so all... Goodison Park's rocking.
Yeah, the game had been drifting then, and Goodison is just insane. I mean, I'd ended up on the pitch after the Horn goal in this sort of scramble of adolescence.
Would it be the last time you ended up on the pitch that afternoon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't have the guts to go on after
that. All right, fair enough.
After the match.
At least you got on there in some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about it in the Blizzard, I think.
It'll be in the next issue, in issue 36.
Yeah. I described it as like drowning... But, you know, I didn't care. And I was under this sort of scramble of bodies. And next thing, I'm hauled up by a steward and literally thrown over the fence and told to get back in my seat, otherwise I'd be arrested.
My goodness. So a 2-2, it's one of those ones where it's Everton's now. Everton pushing forward for the goal, and it comes, and Graeme Stewart gets another one.
Stewart again. I mean, we talk about the greatest goal I've ever seen, and this is possibly one of the most contentious I've seen because of what happened after the game. Stuart Barlow had come on as a substitute, and Barlow was signed as an amateur by Everton. He was a butcher's boy and was incredibly quick, but just had no composure in front of goal and could create chances. And anyway, he came on, and Everton start to wreak havoc in the Wimbledon defence. And I think Stewart played a 1-2 of Tony Cotty as like a wall pass.
But it's one of those 1-2s where he plays it into Cotty and then the ball sort of knocked back into his path. So it's sort of it's not a classic 1-2 of where the angles are cute rather than oblique.
Would you say a wall pass is probably the...
Yeah.
And so I think Sega is slightly unsighted, and I think that gives some excuse for what happened.
Yes. And the ball just bobbles past
him. And then Stewart takes it very early. So the ball's pinged back to him, and he sort of stabs it from the edge of the box. And it sort of just scuttles into the corner, and Sega's a bit slow to get down to it.
Yeah.
But of course, as you say, the goal then becomes this sort of great course celeb 2 or 3 years later.
Well, yeah. I mean, we can talk about that next. But, I mean, Goodison at that stage has just become a nasty... vile atmosphere, and the Wimbledon players, who were the most intimidating team probably in top flight history or in the last 30 years.
I mean, they literally had fear in their midfield.
Yeah, well, they did, but they wanted to get out of there. There was no way that, you know, they'd been offered a trip to Las Vegas by Sam Hammond. There's no way they wanted to be hanging around. So Stewart scores that second goal, 9 minutes left, and everybody's whistling from the crowd. People are sort of at the edge of the fences, ready to invade the pitch. And I, to be perfectly honest, I don't remember anything that happened in the last few minutes other than the whistle went and everybody except me runs onto the pitch. And we still don't know the results.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
The assumption is that we've just stayed up because we've won. But
the manner of that win, having been 2-0 down and then to turn it round.
Yeah. Well, I think Sheffield United went down in the end and they conceded 2 late goals.
Sheffield United, it's a... Ipswich are sort of third bottom in the table as it stands at this point. And then Sheffield United concede, having had the lead, they'd concede an equaliser and they concede a winner or a loser from their point of view in injury time at Chelsea.
Yeah.
And that sends them down. And I think there's some ridiculous statistic with Sheffield United that season that they'd never been in the relegation zone until like the last 17 seconds of the season or something.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and they end up sort of from nowhere. I mean, they must have been sitting there thinking they were safe. They're winning the game.
Yeah.
Everton are getting beat 2-0. Ipswich, I think Ipswich drew in the end that day. Southampton also must have drawn, and then suddenly they get gubbed in injury time.
But nobody had any awareness of this at the time. Yeah. There's no smartphones. So there's a sort of beauty.
I was a tangent. I was at a game in Albania in 2011. I went to Albania to escape the royal wedding, and I was at a Flamatari against FK Tirana game. And I think Flamatari were going with Skenderbeek for the league. And I appeared to be the only person in the stand with a smartphone. So I was sitting there kind of flicking through Skenderbeek's results and going, yeah, they're winning 1-0, sorry. But like just sort of all these like Albanians are crushing around to see my see my smartphone.
Amazing.
Giving me sour plums to make me feel welcome.
Oh, and did you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't order them off a menu, but they're fine.
Yeah, oh, fair enough. But Everton, they survived their long run, if you like, in the top flight was preserved, and as you say, everyone runs on the pitch, and it's one of the sort of greatest escapes, I suppose you could say for a side in the top flight. I mean, after that, did they feel like, right, we've got away with that, now we're going to kick on to the sort of the highs that maybe we achieved in the 80s, or certainly sort of start to go up the table?
Yes, there was a never again mentality. And then what did they go and do? They went until the following November without winning a game.
But they did win the FA Cup that season.
They did win the FA Cup. Joe Royal came in after Walker was sacked. I think Walker was sacked on the 8th of November, having won just one more game after that. And Royal completely turned the team around. But as I say, it was a team full of big characters, and there were some good players there. They had Duncan Ferguson added to that, and they had people like Paul Ryder, who was very underrated, who went on to score the winner in the FA Cup final. I think transforming a team in the mid-90s was a bit easier than it is now. You're not reconstructing the entire fabric of a squad. You're just getting players to play well in their own positions, which is what Royal did.
Yeah, and we should talk about the Hanseggers.
Absolutely.
So, where can we start with this? I mean, it comes out in the Bruce Grobbelaar trial.
Yes.
That
for match fixing.
Yeah, that's Grobbelaar was accused of match fixing, and he sued the News of the World, wasn't it?
The Sun.
The Sun sued the Sun for saying this, and in the course of that trial, this tape comes out in which Grobbelaar appears to say that Seggers was guilty of match fixing and mentions this goal.
Yes, so I like working with goalkeepers, so I worked with Bruce on his book, and specifically worked on the trial aspect and went through the court papers. Bruce is an unusual character. Bruce was being shafted by a former business partner who was a serial con artist, and was stitched up by the Sun. There was no question of that. Bruce didn't cover himself in glory, but as I say, Bruce is an unusual character. So Bruce sort of was intrigued by what his estranged business partner was up to, and wanted to find out, and sort of led him on in the way that you can only really understand if you understand and know Bruce. So it's all there in Bruce's book, and it's all laid out, but of course, it's a colossal news story. You know, it's on the front pages of every newspaper, and Hampshire Police launch an investigation, and they're essentially fishing for any connection between Bruce and other footballers that transcends football, and they happened upon Bruce's relationship with John Fashanu. The two of them had talked about founding a sports agency when they retired. And they looked into Fashanu's affairs, and Fashanu had, some unusual transactions going in and out of his bank account. Seggers was linked to Fashanu because they had a small business that basically let out properties together. And that was it, really. And they constructed this ridiculous case against the three of them and a Malaysian businessman. It cost 12 million quid, and it was just laughable. I mean, the key witness was the aforementioned con artist, and the judge would preface every bit of evidence with, well, members of the jury, you do realise this is a serial con artist speaking, so just bear that in mind.
Yeah.
So it should never have gone to court, never mind five times. Seggers was the first to be acquitted.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely no evidence against
him. I coming back to look at this game again as research for this, I knew that goal was the sort of one that had been held up as being potentially dodgy. And then I watch it happen, and then I have to remind myself that there's supposedly something dodgy about it. Because you see it, and yeah, Segers probably should have done better, but you see that kind of goal every week.
It's not an absolute howler.
No. Stewart takes it quickly, and he's probably partly unsighted. That kind of goal happens. So.
And he made a very good save from Stewart.
From early in the half, yeah, absolutely.
Early in the half.
Yeah. Which is why I always think with the Ramon Quiroga thing with Argentina-Peru in 78, if Quiroga was fixing that game, maybe don't make the six brilliant saves in the first half.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But as you said earlier, you know, never again for Everton. I mean, even though it's been a mixed bag, shall we say, for Everton in the Premier League since then, they've never been relegated and they've managed to maintain that top flight status.
Yeah, they've not been relegated for 67 years, but they're doing their best to try and break that
at the time of recording. Yeah, James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you,
Jonathan, always a pleasure.
Cheers.
Thank you very much for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. We'll see you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.